Hello and welcome to NextPod, VP NextGen's podcast made for veterinary students and young professionals who want to know what's next. I'm your host, Sarah Sed, and this month's topic is diversity and inclusion. To speak on the subject in celebration of Black History Month, we have a very inspiring guest, Dr. Lisa Greenhill, the Association of American Veterinary Medical College's Senior Director for Institutional Research and Diversity. Welcome, Dr. Greenhill.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We're happy to have you. So can you just start by telling us a bit about yourself and kind of how you got here in your current role?
Sure. Well, for folks that don't know, I'm not a veterinarian, so I always feel like I have to kind of disclose that first. But as you mentioned, I am on staff at the Association of American Veterinary Medical Colleges, and my portfolio is I manage our internal research efforts. I study the applicant pool. We collect a lot of institutional research about academic veterinary medicine. But of course, as we're here to talk about today, the other part of my portfolio and really kind of why I came back to the association, because I'd worked here previously and a couple of times, is about diversity and inclusion and kind of helping our colleges develop programming, policies, practices that really promote diversity and inclusion among not only the students, but faculty and staff, house officers, and graduate students as well.
Awesome. So did you always know that you wanted to kind of advocate for people and make a difference? Is that something you always thought?
In an ideal situation, yeah. But did I think I would actually be doing it for a living? Probably not. If I thought back to what I thought I was going to do when I first finished my undergrad degree, but I have had a long career in looking at education issues, higher education issues, specifically through the lens of health professions. And most of that time, of course, has been with AAVMC. And to be able to work on health education and really kind of focus on at least some of my own personal passions around social justice has been a real privilege for sure.
Yeah, no, awesome. And so I did a little digging and I know that you have a BA in government and politics. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So how does that influence the way that you address issues and kind of find solutions right now in your current role?
So I did a BA in government and my master's work was also in public policy, public administration. So I am one of those students who said she was going to go to law school and realized that she didn't want to go to law school, but still was very much engaged and in love with public policy and government and kind of how that understanding how all of that works. Over the course of my career, I started certainly with AAVMC doing policy work, and over the course of my career, that evolved into more education and organizational change work. And the two have dovetailed very nicely. I understand systems, I understand government, I understand policy. And then, as I mentioned, I went back to do a doctorate in education and org change. And those things have been really, really important to my professional development, especially probably in the last 10 years, and kind of helping our colleges move the needle and kind of change not only their kind of policies and practices, but really kind of dealing with the nuts and bolts of that organizational change stuff and kind of understanding what works and what doesn't and applying it. So you know, for everybody out there, if you're not sure what your degree is gonna do for you, it'll all work out.
Yeah. So actually, you also have a podcast with the AAVMC. So it's called Diversity and Inclusion on Air.
Yes.
And I just was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that and kind of what made you think that, you know, what was the turning point that made the AAVMC decide to do a platform like that?
Sure. So I was really interested in finding avenues and kind of creating new opportunities for us to push diversity and equity and inclusion programming out of the association and really kind of trying to find new ways of reaching people that didn't just require them to go to a meeting, me submitting an abstract, me kind of fighting with the people and saying, no, this is really important and is as important as, you know, all of the other things that we spend time talking about. And so I came up with the idea of the podcast, I think about 5 years ago now. And I remember talking to Dr. Andy McCabe, who's our CEO, and I said, I got this idea, I'm going to do this thing, and if it doesn't work, then we'll never speak of it again. And again, that was 5 years ago, and we now have about 60 episodes on topics around diversity and inclusion all through the profession. And so we talk about race, we talk about gender, we talk about disability, we talk about different kinds of disability, physical, neurocognitive, we talk about rural practice, we talk about urban practice. I mean, any type of diversity like concept that we can kind of apply to the profession, I'm interested in doing shows on. And it's been a really fun way of getting out information and doing education in a really different, accessible way. It's free. You can get it on all platforms. Here I am going into my like spiel. You can get it on all platforms. And, you know, it's a lot of fun. And again, like this, it's very conversational. So there's no like, you know, state, like here's a PowerPoint presentation and walk you through it. No, it's just professionals and experts kind of talking about things that are really important around D&I in the profession. So really fun.
I definitely think that's an important, and like you said, like it's basically just a conversation that, you know, you're listening in on. And I think it's like a really easy way to get people interested in those kinds of topics and starting conversations, you know, as beyond the podcast as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we've been really pleased with the distribution and the way that it's being used, the way that folks are listening to it. We typically have about 1,000 listens a month to the show when it comes out. I take breaks this time of year and during the summer, of course. But students are listening to it. Faculty are listening to it. Professionals are listening to it. And not just in the States, but globally. And so it's just a really cool, it's become a really cool tool for us to talk about some really interesting things. But it also has given us a platform to have conversations in a really timely way as well. So if something happens in the D&I space that potentially affects our members, you know, we can pull together a show pretty quickly and have some meaningful conversations and not just a press release or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. So you also have something called the Diversity Matters Initiative at the AAVMC. What does that entail?
So actually the podcast kind of would fit under that umbrella. And so the initiative is really, we launched it in 2005. So it's about 14 years old, no, 15, 14, something like that. And so there's just a collection of programs and things that we do with the colleges. So the podcast one program, we have a program devoted to holistic review and admissions and kind of helping our member institutions kind of use best practices and evidence-based best practices around diversity and inclusion in the admissions process. We look at climate at the colleges and do some research on that. And then consultation program evaluation with the colleges that invite me out to kind of sit down and talk with them about what they're doing and what they could be doing better and what they could be starting. And so there's a whole kind of collection, a suite of different kinds of programs that fall under the initiative that keep the staff here at AAVMC pretty busy, and me specifically. And the podcast is just one, you know, just one slice of that.
Okay, awesome. Well, if you don't mind, I'm just going to get right into our questions. Yeah. So diversity is a subject that's really being discussed more and more nowadays, whether it's online, within organizations, schools, institutions. The topic affects obviously countless people, particularly the younger generation, you know, kind of wanting to get into veterinary medicine at this point. So can you please share with us what you think is really important for people to know when it comes to diversity and inclusion within the vet industry? And like, how would you describe diversity within the vet industry right now?
So kind of a loaded question. So yes. Oftentimes when we talk about diversity and inclusion, and sometimes I'll mention that as D&I kind of for short. So sometimes folks immediately think that we're talking exclusively about race, ethnicity, or gender. But diversity is far more broad than that. So we're talking about different kinds of abilities, disabilities. We're talking about sexual orientation. We're talking about background. We're talking about first generation and low income. We're talking about a number of different kinds of kind of personal dimensions and experiences that typically come with those dimensions, and the value that these individuals can bring to the profession. And so right now, according to the Census Bureau, the veterinary profession is about 92% white in terms of race, and probably about 60% female, women, made up of women. And so, you know, those are kind of unbalanced.
It's known to be the whitest profession, correct? Like, quote unquote.
Right. Yeah. There's been several articles about the lack of diversity with respect to race.
Yes.
Certainly we hear about the lack of gender diversity within the colleges. We also should mention things like, you know, only about 11% of our student body identify as having some type of disability, whether it's physical or neurocognitive. We have about 10% that identify as LGBT. We have, you know, there's all kinds of different folks that are now represented among our student body, and even including certainly our faculty as well. But the reality is that we still have a lot of underrepresented and or marginalized identities that are kind of external to the profession. And, you know, we have to serve those populations. And I'm not suggesting that really great, amazing white folks can't do that, or, you know, white folks or white women in particular. What I'm suggesting, though, and what the data show in healthcare, as well as kind of business more broadly, is that the more heterogeneous your team, the better, more productive that team is going to be. We know that from human health studies that the more diverse the team, you're really going to just see much better medicine practiced overall, right? You're going to see a reduction in errors. You're going to see a higher compliance rate for aftercare, all of those kinds of things. And then I just like to say, you know, it's the right thing to do. I don't like to focus as much on kind of that moral imperative, but it is the right thing to do. just because I don't say that as much, it doesn't mean that it's not really important. So there's a business case, there's a medical case, and then it's just, there is kind of that moral imperative that it is the right thing to do, to be a profession that's open and welcoming to the populations, the diverse populations that we serve.
Yeah, and I mean, a big part of that is a lack of representation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it kind of like goes full circle where there aren't people being represented, therefore maybe young people will not want to go into that profession, and then it just continues, the cycle goes on and on. So, I mean, is there any way where does that start? Because I know that I actually watched a speech by Dr. Coretta Patterson of Sierra Veterinary Specialists. Yeah, she's from Nevada, and she spoke at the UC Davis Pre-Health Conference about diversity in 2014. And she actually mentioned a study that you did, I believe you did, in the late 1990s in New York. Was it in New York among seventh graders? Seventh grade
students?
That
was not me, but I do know who did that study.
Oh, okay, sorry. She did mention your name. I figured it was a while back.
I think that was Anton Asare, but yeah. So
okay. Yeah. And I mean, what she was saying basically was that, you know, at that age, when you're in seventh grade, a lot of young people are passionate about, you know, they want to pursue the veterinary profession. They want to go into it, but because they're kind of, you know, not guided or don't get enough information, or maybe it's a lack of representation as well, like they just don't end up pursuing it. So where is that kind of line where people, like, what can people do to really change that?
So mentorship is really, really important. And I know that, you know, we talk about kind of the problem with the lack of mentors. So if you don't see yourself, then can you really be that, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is that if we're still kind of waiting for some spontaneous, you know, diverse populations to just show up. That's just not how, I mean, if this was a naturally occurring phenomenon, I would be doing something different professionally, right? So, because it wouldn't be a problem, right? And so there has to be a commitment from our existing professionals, and not just our professionals of color, and not just our men or women, whatever, but everyone saying we really are concerned about the future of the profession. And in that concern, we are making a commitment to mentor and sponsor students of color, male students, students from rural backgrounds, low income, first gen, you know, and the list goes on and on, that we're making a deliberate and intentional commitment to mentor and sponsor those students such that they develop an interest, retain that interest, and actually eventually apply and become DVM students with, you know, the trajectory on into the profession. And so cross-race, cross-gender mentoring and sponsorship happens all the time, but we don't see nearly as much of it, I think, as we could see in veterinary medicine. And I think that that's something that we can all do to make a big difference in shoring up and growing the pipeline of students so that it's that pipeline is far more diverse and looks a lot more like where we want to go. It's not going to happen overnight, but it has to be a long-term kind of commitment to grooming and developing that pipeline.
Yeah, and I know there's a recent analysis done by the AAVMC on the VMCAs that shows kind of the discrepancy between the diversity of populations in undergraduate schools as compared to the current applicant pool in veterinary medicine. So in your opinion, like, where does that disproportion begin, and how can the situation be improved, you know, to reflect the actual demographics of the United States, for example?
Yeah. So where did it begin? I mean, this is a long story. You know, once upon a time, the profession was a lot more overtly discriminatory than it is now. I mean, I pull no punches about that. There's a long history, frankly, of discrimination against people of color, against religious groups, against women in this profession that is pretty well documented. And while we're moving past that history, the reality is that we're moving past it much more slowly than some of the other health professions that have really taken this on and spent a lot more dedicated time over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And so, we have schools that didn't graduate their first African American until almost the 90s, you know, I mean, that's still a thing, that's why that discrepancy exists. The more positive way of looking at this, when we look at the cohorts that are studying in the undergraduate programs, is that our pool has a lot of potential. Right? There's a very, very diverse pool of students that we are not pulling from. And what we need to be doing, again, is that mentoring, that shoring up, that applicant and development to really kind of let folks know that this is a profession that's open to them, and that it can help them achieve their professional goals, particularly if they already have an interest in STEM careers, in the biological sciences, the agricultural sciences. We know that those students, those populations in undergrad programs are growing, and that there's a lot more diversity there than there used to be. So we just really need to find better ways of tapping into that.
Yeah, awesome. And is there a difference at HBCUs in terms of African Americans that are applying for vet school? And because I know there's Tuskegee University in Alabama is one of the vet schools that is an HBCU. Does that play a role at all? Does that change it, anything?
So I would say that certainly Tuskegee is still one of our biggest producers, specifically of African-American veterinarians. But we're certainly seeing a lot more diversity across all of our institutions. And certainly I think that what we'll find in, analysis across institutions is that just sheer location sometimes can affect that. So, we see in our Western schools, we'll see a lot more Latino students, Latinx students in our schools in California, on the West Coast, Oregon, Washington, just because there's a higher density of those applicants from those particular parts of the country versus Oklahoma, where we see a larger number of our Indigenous or Native American students in Oklahoma State. And so I will say that for more broadly, not just HBCUs, but minority serving institutions more broadly. So there's, HBCUs or historically Black colleges and universities, there's Hispanic serving institutions, tribal colleges, Asian Pacific and Native Hawaiian schools in Hawaii and Alaska. We'll see that those schools have students that are very interested. What happens is that we don't recruit as much. And so sometimes it's really just getting in front of those students and saying, hey, here are some opportunities for you. We're not even talking about long-term mentoring, just like, hey, we're really interested. Does anybody want to be a veterinarian? Because we also know from the research that we do at the association that most students express an interest in being a veterinarian before the age of 10. And so what happens, overwhelmingly, our applicants say that they, just kind of a very, very young wanted to be a veterinarian.
They just know,
right? I tell people all the time, it's like an ecclesiastical calling that they just know that they want to be a veterinarian. But what happens for some marginalized or underrepresented populations is their interest levels initially are no different. But what happens is that there's a number of barriers that kind of they bump into and really kind of changes their pipeline route to something else. And so we need to, one, stay in front of them to kind of keep that interest, but also be looking in to try to evaluate barriers that exist and getting those barriers down so that those qualified applicants can come and really have that opportunity to pursue the profession.
Yeah, for sure. So does funding play a role at all when it comes to, reaching out and really getting them kind of wanting to really pursue the veterinary field?
So I guess it depends on what do you mean by funding. So
there a lack of funding maybe that is stopping initiatives to take place?
Sure. So I think that historically, one of the things that I've noted over the years is that because so many students in the profession and professionals in general say that they wanted to be a veterinarian since they were very, very young, this is not a profession that has had to recruit. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so there was just a steady stream of folks, saying I've been called to be a veterinarian. Right. And when you have that kind of population, you kind of really kind of rest a bit on your laurels and don't have to recruit as much. But in the last probably 20, 30 years, I think that has really changed, particularly with the rise of the tech industry. It's siphoning off a lot of folks. Again, it's a STEM. It's in the STEM, grouping. And so that's siphoning off a lot of folks that might have been really interested in veterinary medicine at some point. and so historically, the colleges didn't have to allocate much to devote to recruiting. The flip side of that is so many programs, like in medicine and dentistry, there are a lot of programs that do exposure and enrichment programming for undergrad or high school students, particularly those from marginalized backgrounds. And we just don't have as many of those kinds of programs for folks in our pipeline. Those programs can be kind of expensive for them to really kind of have their biggest bang for the buck. It's best to kind of keep them low or no cost to the student. And so really kind of trying to be competitive, get those grant monies, but also investing hard money into those programs so that students have an opportunity for enrichment and exposure to the profession is really, really important. But right now, we're seeing a lot more of it, but across our institutions, but there's always a need for more, always a need.
Yeah. And I noticed you talked a little bit about the rise of technology. How has social media really played a role in terms of diversity and inclusion? Has that helped at all? Or is there anything like you have to say on that subject?
Boy, so yes and no. With technology, there's always a double-edged sword, right? And so, so in terms of getting people engaged and active, yes. Along with the podcast, I maintain a page on Facebook that's dedicated to the podcast where I post lots of articles and all kinds of things. And that's been really another great vehicle for us to push out information. But, you know, if you're talking more broadly, like on Twitter, for example, you know, it's one of those things where for every, you know, one thing that you post that is like, oh, diversity, there's someone that's like, that's trash. So, you know, it is, if we're looking at like social justice Twitter, of course, there's like all kinds of really great stuff to get folks out. I certainly encourage people to follow me, and there's a whole list of people that I recommend folks follow if they're interested more in D&I work in the Twitterverse, if you will. I think it can be, it like anything, it's a great tool, but it also comes with its own challenges. So.
Yeah, no,
trolling
for
is
sure.
a thing. Trolling is a thing. so proceed with caution.
So I know you just mentioned also like social justice Twitter, and how, you know, nowadays there's organizations, great organizations like Black Lives Matter that are bring about awareness and advocating for change. Has that kind of movement affected the veterinary industry? Have you noticed a specific change in regards to that?
Not so much. I do know that like there's groups like Black Docs, White Coats, and groups like that zero in not just kind of on the larger Black Lives Matter piece, but really kind of zeroing in on healthcare and health equity. I think that those are really great tools. I do see groups like Voice kind of adopting aspects of those movements to kind of infuse some of their work. I think that they're great movements, particularly when they are, for our purposes in veterinary medicine, really kind of zeroed in on healthcare delivery, health equity, and kind of meeting clients where they are, right? And so I think that they can be really great tools, but we haven't really seen as much with that yet in veterinary medicine. But I imagine that as more students, I think that what we're seeing with Gen Y or Gen Z is Gen Z, right? Somebody's going to totally okay boomer me, but what we're seeing is that the population of students that are coming into DVM programs right now are a lot more socially active, a lot more engaged, and certainly use platforms like Twitter to do and be more engaged and be a bit more activist. I predict that will continue to, that kind of activism and movement will grow in veterinary medicine. I'm not really sure what that's going to look like, but I won't be surprised to see more of it in the future.
Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, this is a little bit of a jump question.
Yeah.
Kind of different, but I was just wondering kind of what your opinion was on tokenism in regards to the veterinary industry. Does that play a role at all when it comes to representation?
So,
and for those who don't know what tokenism is, could you describe it a little?
So it's essentially kind of being the lonely only, right? And so, so for example, there's a panel at an upcoming conference, and so we see this a lot at conferences, and not just in veterinary medicine, but just in conferences in general. And I know that there's been a lot on social media about this now lately. And that is, so there's a panel of all men, and it's all white men. And then someone goes, oh no, this is not what we want to portray. Those folks are great. It's great, but aren't there other great folks that we could include, right? And so then what ends up potentially happening is either that they just kind of invite that one woman that one black and brown or brown person, that one person who's, you know, bilingual, like they'll invite that one person.
The token person.
And then, you know, during the discussion it's like, and from Black America, here is Lisa. Like, you know, kind of, you know, do I see it in veterinary medicine? Not nearly as much as I used to. We've just adopted at AAVMC some guidelines around how to be very conscious about avoiding that particular scenario and certainly others like it. I don't see it as much because I do think that there's a greater sensitivity around conference planning for some topics. I think that again, this profession is not very diverse in a number of ways. And so sometimes the pool seems very shallow in terms of picking and highlighting talent, but folks are there. You might just have to peel back a couple of layers. But do I think it is a substantive problem in the way that I do more broadly? I mean, there are times, but I guess for me, that's not where I spend most of my time fretting, I guess. But tokenism is always an issue because it puts the air quote token, the person who with the marginalized or underrepresented identity on the hotspot to represent everyone. Mm-hmm. And they're not just representing everyone that looks like them, they're representing everyone who doesn't look like anybody else on that stage or in mm-hmm. that platform. And that's a huge burden when it's already burdensome to just be the lonely only. There comes a lot of responsibility. There comes a lot of pressure. And then you have folks that, you know, potentially might do small microaggressions like, oh my goodness, you spoke so well, or you did so great. And it's like, well, they invited me to talk. Did you think I was going to not be? I mean, not all speakers are great, but it's like, well, what were your expectations, right? And so it's definitely something that I do think about, but probably not where I spend most of my energy.
Yeah. So kind of now I was wondering if I ask you a question specific to like the students. So, you know, if a student or a young professional, I guess this could apply to anybody really in the veterinary industry. If they're in a situation where they feel like somebody maybe is acting inappropriately when it comes to inclusivity, maybe something with the language they're using or their behavior, is there a way that they can, you know, address that in a professional way, in the right way? And can it be reported in an organization or to somebody if that does happen?
Yeah. So my first recommendation is to take a breath. And sometimes I was just telling some students this last week that when someone says something kind of crazy or inappropriate to me, I usually take a moment of silence. And that moment might last as long as 10 seconds. And part of it is because we are so conditioned to fill space mm-hmm. because, you know, quiet is awkward and we don't like it. Yeah. But it's okay to take that time and to be pensive and thoughtful about what your next move is going to be. But the other thing is that I have found in my own life and in my work is that if I can get that 10 seconds of silence, it also is an aha moment, maybe for the person with whom I'm having this interaction, because it's just long enough and awkward enough for them to go, did I say something inappropriate? Yes, you did. So sometimes that creates an opportunity for you to meaningfully visit with that person about why that moment was uncomfortable. The other thing is after that, or if you can't do that, then I sometimes have to take a step away and I say, can we reconvene in like 10 minutes, or can I have a minute with you in a bit, or I might save it until towards the close of that, that interaction or that conversation to kind of bring it back. Keep your cool. unless something really crazy has been said. Keep your cool. And I always will also ask, like, can I give you some feedback on something that happened? And I really kind of, something that made me uncomfortable. And I try to also assume good intentions. It can be really hard, and depending on what is said, sometimes you can determine good intention. But assuming good intention and assuming collegiality can be really helpful in engaging in what is, in my opinion, a necessary confrontation. And in my own work in this system, in the profession, is that veterinary medicine is heavily populated with folks who are averse to confrontation. So it can be kind of challenging, but that's why, you know, tone is important and saying, can I give you a little bit of feedback so that you don't do this to someone else, including me in the future. And, you know, I also, for me, deal with things, laughter and humor is a coping strategy for me. So sometimes I will go to that place as well, which is oftentimes disarming enough for me to be able to engage and have the type of feedback and confrontation that I need to feel good. Mm-hmm. I will say this, if you feel like in that moment, there's not a trust, a minimum level of trust that will allow you to do that, it is okay to practice self-preservation and self-protection. It is okay not to go down that path. It is okay to not feel like you have to educate the world. It really is. That's not necessarily your job. We're all just kind of living and minding our own business and getting on with life. And so if it really is such an uncomfortable situation, it's okay to walk away. But if you can have that meaningful interaction where there is a teachable moment and it's not too burdensome, teach.
Definitely. Thank you. And I know that many young people, especially because, you know, if they just are overwhelmed with school or just the new role of being a veterinarian, oftentimes if they have moments like that, like you mentioned, that are difficult to process, they can tend to feel isolated because they don't know who to go to. Maybe there's not that many people around them that would understand. Is there other strategies that you have to kind of help them deal with those feelings and how to, you know, approach that when it comes to working in a professional environment as well? It's more challenging, of course.
Yeah. And so, you know, I know that this is something that we kind of intended on touching on, but these are very real issues for everyone. I think that everyone kind of has these moments, irrespective of race or gender or background. For me, again, I can kind of talk very broadly programmatically, but I also certainly recommend I recommend having someone to talk to, and not just a good friend, but a professional. It's okay to go to therapy. It's okay to talk about it. It's okay to talk it out, to bounce ideas, to get that personal kind of feedback that helps you find that place within yourself where you can get that strength to have the kind of conversations that push you forward. And not just you, I think that it's important to recognize that when we engage in these conversations, they are mutually beneficial, right? When you give that kind of feedback saying, hey, what I think that you said, that thing you said came off as, you know, kind of sexist, can we talk about it? It really it's good to have that conversation and to be able to bring it to positive resolution means that the work environment is going to be better. The relationship is going to be, you know, not damaged, and potentially that relationship will actually advance as well. Greater productivity, all of those things that kind of flow from a healthier work environment and healthier relationships. And so get the type of coaching that you and mentorship that you need to be able to do that. It's not just about learning how to suture stuff and all of that kind of mentoring, but also those communication and personal development skills that are really necessary that help you be able to handle that interracial, intergendered, whatever kind of conversations are necessary to be had. So find somebody to talk to.
Yeah, definitely. Think
get a mentor, talking about get your squad. Yeah,
yeah,
get your
letting mentor. It out.
Yeah, don't bottle it up. It's not good for you. It's not healthy. And we also recognize, we also really have to be very clear, and I want to be very, very clear with your listeners that persistent discrimination is something that cannot coexist with wellness programs. Those two things don't go together. Like, if you have a commitment to wellness, then you have to have a commitment to anti-discrimination. Mm-hmm. Discrimination and wellness do not go together. They don't. So there's that.
And definitely mental health is a huge topic among veterinary professionals right now. I know a lot of students, they want to, you know, write about it with us and talk about those things. And I think it's important definitely to note that there is a relationship between inclusivity and
absolutely
mental health, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't, I mean, if, like I said, if you're committed to one, you have to be committed to the other. Otherwise you're just throwing water out the window. So.
Yeah. It's all, cause at the end of the day, it's all really about a community environment, especially when, I mean, veterinarians, I mean, they have that passion since they're like born, it sounds So, you know, fostering that kind of community with people that have a like-minded passion as you and being inclusive, definitely is something that I think sharing those experiences with those people is something that can, you know, help.
It'll bring you together. And again, you know, not to be tactless, but there is a business case for all of this, but there's also a good medical case for all of this. If you don't have these kinds of, if the isms and the phobias and the discrimination is not something that is present and or pervasive in your learning or work environment, then everybody's going to be a lot happier and a lot more productive.
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you. That was a great, great answer. I have one last question for you in regards to this topic.
Sure.
And it's a little bit more of a personal experience question. Can you share a story about a particular experience in regards to diversity and inclusion that has shaped you or someone you know that can kind of inspire or, you know, just kind of help people relate a little bit to how it really feels, what it really feels like to go through something that changes you, that shapes you like that?
Oh.
It doesn't have to be super detailed, but just kind of, you know, how you overcame something, maybe like how you particularly felt stronger.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I think that I've been around the profession since the mid-90s. And very, very early in my career, I was almost always the only one that looked like me in a room. Those were kind of not just my formative years working in the profession, but they were my formative years professionally in general. And there were times when folks were not very nice to me. There were folks that weren't very nice to me. There were folks that were pretty kind of openly nasty sometimes. I heard a lot of things and saw a lot of things. And I guess for me, I'm still here. I persisted because I have come to love the profession more than I hate those things that happened, right? And I think that there are a lot of people like me walking around. There are wounds, there are scars, and I think that we have to acknowledge that there are a lot of walking wounded folks around that are deeply affected by bigotry, racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, all of these kinds of ableism. And yet we all stay around because we love the work, We love the profession. We want to see the profession thrive. I want to make sure that my sweet little dog, Barkley, has a great healthcare provider that I can take him to, that I'm able to connect with. Because I mean, I trust the veterinarians on the medicine. I really do. And I think a lot of people do. The breakdown is in the human communication. And so I want to make sure that everyone that wants to see a veterinarian, whether it is for traditional kind of clinical care for their animals or their farm animals, their production animals, but also in public health and all of the other spaces, that folks are getting what they need out of this profession. And I think that long-term homogeneity is not sustainable as a business model. And I want this profession to be successful. So I'm still here and I'm still, you know, rising above. Sometimes some wacky things happen. Again, not nearly what they were many years ago, but yeah, I've seen some things and I've heard some things. So I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing that. I know sometimes those kinds of things can be a little bit difficult to talk about or to really express. But thank you, because I know, I'm sure there's many students that are, you know, feeling like confused or feeling a little bit alone. And I think it's really good for them to hear somebody who's experienced and who's been there and who's kind of conquered those feelings and made it and loves their job.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you're not alone. You're not alone. Oftentimes we think we are. And one of the worst things about both kind of the diversity space and the wellness space, one of the most challenging things in both kind of camps is that we often think that we're alone in the feelings and experiences that we're having, and we're really not. There are a community of folks and you know, find your people and connect, offer peer support is really important. Mentoring is really important, but find those things, and those folks that kind of help sustain you and, allow you to persist for another day.
Yeah, very true. And thank you so much for taking the time again to share your experiences and your advice to our listeners. So we actually want to end every podcast with a little Q&A that kind of shows off. It's super quick, super fun. So let's get started. So really, what is your ultimate career goal at the moment?
My goodness, just in case. Just in case Dr. McCabe is listening. I plan on staying here until I die. No, I'm kidding. You know, I'm not really sure where my career will go at this point. I love what I'm doing. I'm having a really great time. I have I work with an amazing team of individuals, both in AAVMC and with our members, and certainly my colleagues at other veterinary professional organizations like AVMA. I'm hoping to keep doing what I'm doing, and continuing to be creative and innovative and creating new things. And we'll see what goes from there.
Cool. So do you have a quote or a philosophy that you live by that kind of keeps you going?
Yeah. So if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I'm a huge lover of the writer James Baldwin. One of my favorite quotes is that we can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. I dig that. I'm like, we're cool till you cross this line. You know, if what you're saying and what you believe are diametrically opposed to my very humanity and existence, then I can't rock with you. Like, otherwise we're cool, but I can't rock with you if you don't respect my right to be here.
That's a really good quote. Yeah. So the next one is, who inspires you to continue to make a change within the industry?
Oh my goodness, there's so many people. I stand on the shoulders of giants and amazing ancestors. And so I certainly among many is Patricia Lowry, who used to be at Michigan State. She is very much like a professional mom to me. Dr. Willie Reed, who's dean at Purdue. Dr. Phil Nelson, dean at Western University in Pomona, but also amazing folks like the late Billy Hooper, and the late Dr. Atkinson, who was a dean at Tuskegee. These individuals, and Dr. Blackwell as well, former dean at Tennessee, these individuals are just amazing folks that kind of came up and came into the profession at really demanding and transitional times. And I look up to them so much. I'm proud to call them my colleagues and my friends. And they have mentored me and taught me so much over the course of my adult life. I've known most of them now more than longer than my teen, you know, my adolescent years at this point. They are lifelong friends and colleagues, and I just admire all of them and so many other people as well so much, and just want to publicly thank them for all of the tomfoolery that they've allowed for me.
So on that note, what is some advice that you can pass along to young people who really want to start a career in veterinary medicine?
Based on
your experience at the AAVMC, I guess.
Yeah, so a couple of things. Definitely check out our website for all kinds of good information about getting ready to apply to vet school. Really look at some of the things that we're doing along with our partner organizations and our members to improve the quality of education and surrounding support systems at the colleges. And to all of the students, I think that live and walk in your authenticity, be exactly who you are without compromise. I wish that I'd learned that at a much younger age, care less about what other people think, but, be your whole and authentic self and demand that, you know, we come into these spaces not having to leave bits and pieces of ourselves behind us. We want you to come into this profession and change the world. And in order to really be able to do that, you have to be your whole self. So, I can tell you all the things that you should do to fill out an application, and I can work with the colleges on admissions, and all of those things are so important to your future. But in terms of just general life, Lisa-ism life advice, be your authentic self 24/7.
Yeah, that's really good advice for sure.
Yeah.
And so lastly, where can people find you, like email, social media, website, et cetera?
Sure. So you can find me at the association what is my email address? L Greenhill, that's LGREENHILL at AAVMC.org. You can find me on Twitter at LM_Greenhill, LM_GREENHILL. That's probably where I hang out the most. Certainly you can also find the podcast, like I said, on most podcast apps under AAVMC, Diversity and Inclusion on Air. And you can find the Facebook page by the same name.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Dr. Greenhill. We really appreciate you being with us. And a big thank to our Next Pod listeners. Remember, you are the future. Join us next month for another in-depth talk. We will be touching on equality within the veterinary industry in celebration of Women's History Month with Dr. Bridget Heilsberg from the Women's Veterinary Leadership Development Initiative. Talk soon.